are listening to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church.
Romans 7, 5 through 6. When we were in the flesh, so a question about that is, what does that mean? Galatians 2:20, of course, says what? The life that I live now, what? In the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God. So how is it that Paul can say in Romans 7, when we were in the flesh, speaking about living the Christian life as something that is present, living in the flesh is something before I was saved. But then in Galatians 2:20, he says, I'm living in the flesh, depending on this, on Christ. So what are we talking about in that phrase? I think that's important. The sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members. And this is an interesting thing too. The sinful passions which were aroused by the, we would think it says something like the flesh, but it actually says they were aroused by the law. Where did the law come from? Well, God. And so the law stirs up sinful passions in us. Another thing that Paul is going to talk about more later, but he introduces here. They were at work in our members, our body, to bear fruit to death. But now we have been delivered from the law, having died to what we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit, not in the oldness of the letter. What is new and what is old mean? We want to talk about that too. Any thoughts or questions about this passage before we jump right in? I'll give you that chance on the front end this week. As you look at this, you read this, or you've thought about it this week, anything you want to make sure we talk about? Any questions you have about these two verses? Let's talk about some of the words. The word flesh, sarx. So I was a Greek teacher in college. I have all these memory aids to get people to remember Greek words so that they pass quizzes and tests. Anyone want to tell me how I would get them to remember that sarx means flesh? No, that's deep. The sarx, I don't even know about the sarx virus. No? Sharks eat flesh. So sharks. You have it's not shark, it's sark, but still it works. Sarks. Sarks or sarcos, flesh, human body, human nature, humanity. So there's a range here. And I think what we want to point out here is that, we'll talk about it later, it doesn't always mean the bad part of the flesh. Sometimes it just means the physical side of my existence. So it's talking about the physical part of us. Flesh. Passions. Pathema. What is suffered? And I think when we read this word, the thing that comes to mind to us is something like lust. Lustful desires, but there's another word that's epithumia in Greek. This is a different word, pathema, so it actually means something more like not just a lustful desire, but it's a suffering, it's something that you suffer. It's an emotion, it's a passion, but not in a lustful way necessarily, it's more of an affliction. It's something that you go through, a suffering. And so he's really talking about this, these sinful suffering experiences that we have in the flesh. So he's emphasizing something a little different than what we would, on the surface, guess at. We would guess on a surface reading he's talking about lustful desires. Not exactly the case. Aroused. The word aroused is interesting because it's not actually in Greek. If you were translating from Greek to English, you would get to this place and you would say, well, it's not there. Did the translators add a word? This is something that is supplied by translations to complete the thought in English. Strictly literal translation would be something like this. In the dot, dot, dot is where the aroused would go. But literally, just strictly in a wooden sense, the sinful passions, which through the law were at work in our body parts. What does it mean, the sinful passions at work in our body parts through the law? Well, the law is doing something. And the best way to say it is something like aroused, stirring up, something like that. And we get that also from a passage later on. As you read down in Romans 7, he continues to talk about this dynamic of what the law causes to happen in us when we're sinners. So I just mentioned that because if you looked this up in a dictionary this week, you would say, well, it's not there. Well, it's not. It's there to make the translation make sense. At work, energeo, and we've talked about this word, I think, in a noun form. Energy is a word we use today that's similar. At work, it means to effect, to put in operation, to be active. Something that is happening. Then you have this word, katargeo. Katargeo, to render useless, render inoperative, render powerless, to cancel, to bring to an end, to release. This is used in Romans 6:6, as you might recall. The rendering inoperative idea. And he brings it back here. A good example of this would be to just envision what it's like when you have a plug plugged in and you pull the plug out of the socket. I mean, technically it's still there, but it's now rendered inoperative. There's no power there anymore. Parts are there, but the power is not. It's been released. Held. Kateko. To hold down. To help you think through this a little bit too, echo is a word, this half, echo. It means to have. Kateko strengthens it by adding a preposition to the front. To hold down, to detain, to retain, to hinder or restrain, to hold firm in grasp. So it takes the idea of having something and it just intensifies it to give it some more meaning. To hinder, to restrain, to hold firm in grasp. The word duluo, serve, to be in slavery or subjection. We've talked about this in Romans 6 especially. Now, old and new. Oldness and newness. In Romans chapter 6, Paul talks about we are now serving God in the newness of the Spirit, not in the oldness of the letter. What does this mean? The word newness, kainotes, connotes, describes our new relationship with God through Christ as being recent. It's a kind of life that was previously impossible and not existent. It doesn't mean that the Holy Spirit didn't exist before, but it means that this is a new development. If you follow Cars, which I did in high school, I used to devour Motor Trend magazine and Mustang Monthly. All that did was give me a couple illustrations today. I could have studied better things with my time. But teenagers do that. We get fascinated by things that have short value. You would read magazines like that, and these magazines would introduce you to new cars. Oh, this year, Chrysler's coming out with... But sometimes the new car wasn't actually a new car. It was new because it was recently produced, but it was just another version of something that they already made they just changed the way that the headlamps look a little bit and added a couple horsepower to the engine. It's not actually a new car. It's a modified car that was recently produced. But every now and then they would produce a car that actually was new. It was a brand new chassis. It was a brand new model. It had never been made before. It never existed before. Now you have the opportunity to do this. Minivans, when they were introduced, that was more than a new car. It was a new kind of car. Muscle cars were a new kind of car back in the 1960s when they were introduced. Now they keep making different versions of them, but they were a new kind. That's the idea here when he says the newness of the Spirit. Beginning with the first century, post-resurrection of Jesus Christ, the time that Paul was writing and ministering, that first century, from that point forward, a new kind of life was made available. This was not a kind of life that was livable before. You couldn't have this kind of experience before Christ. It was new. It wasn't a spin-off. It wasn't a new variation of the Old Testament. It was a new way of living. A spirit type of lifestyle that was not available to Old Testament saints. Sadly, we often still live like Old Testament saints. That's this kind of the problem that Paul's starting to deal with here. We live like we're in the Old Testament when we're not. We're not living in a smaller, modified version of Old Testament living. We have a brand new way of living. We have to get a hold of that. Oldness is the opposite of newness. Palaiotes, it describes life prior to the resurrection of Christ as being obsolete, outdated, extinct, archaic, and no longer relevant or in force. When I was in undergrad school, I thought I was living on the cutting edge. Some of you will look at this and say, wow, that was not the cutting edge. A couple of weeks ago, I just, after supper, went over to the sofa and I started pulling out old games on YouTube that I used to play. I used to play Gorf. You did not have to know what that was. Gorf on the VIC-20 and the Commodore 64. Anyone remember that? It's a weird place in technology. No one remembers it. But we had one of those, and you'd play it off of a cassette. And you'd stick the cassette in the tape drive, and you'd play Gorf. And I was showing it to my kids, and then I showed them Commander Keen and Secret Agent Man, and you don't even know what these things are. Oregon Trail, the original version, not the deluxe edition. My kids watched these videos on YouTube with me, and I was reliving my memories, and James just, he's looking, and then he looked at me, and he said, "Dad, those are really strange." Yeah, he would get no fun out of playing those games today. When I was in college, I had finally talked my parents into getting me a Palm Pilot. I think it was 4 or 5. It was this plastic, heavy, clunky thing with an LCD screen that was the green, well, the two shades of green, however you describe those screens back then, had a plastic stylus and you could poke it and put your to-do list and your calendar on there. And if you were cool at school, you would carry your Palm Pilot around. You'd lay it out on the desk. I am an organized person because I have a Palm Pilot. Well, today, if I walked in with a Palm Pilot, you would say, "What is that?" It runs on 2 AA batteries as a plastic stylus. I couldn't sell it on eBay if I tried, not even as an antique. It's not worth anything. But that was cutting-edge technology back then. What would you think if that's how I lived today? Walked around playing Commodore 64 games and running off of my Palm Pilot. Was obsolete. That's what Paul is talking about here. We used to live one way. The oldness of the letter is an obsolete way of living. It was real. It happened. It was the way things were, but it's old today. It's obsolete. It's outdated. No longer relevant. We live in a new way that is now available to us. It's not even that we have two ways that God says you can live this way or that way. It's the only thing going, if you actually want to live for God. It's the only way going. The other you can do, but it's very obsolete and you're not going to make progress. It's extinct, archaic. Living according to the law is living in an extinct lifestyle. It's like spiritual caveman living. We still do it. Letter, gramma, that which is written or drawn, a letter, a character of the alphabet, a writing or a book. It's the thinking. Is there a rule for that? That's the thinking. I think I just broke a rule right there. I go to Tom Wiley's house and he does it. Said, oh, I must be more spiritual than Tom because he just broke a rule. At least I think it's the rule. I think it's what Christians do. And you have all of these rules in your mind. And wherever you go, whoever you meet, and even at church, you're just always on pins and needles. As inside, if you'd be honest, you got a bunch of rules. You got to make sure you don't break them. And that's the way. They're written down somewhere. The problem is we have rules today that aren't even written down. We have so many that we're trying to keep track of sometimes. And that's an old way of living. And you can try to keep living that way if you want. It's no fun. There is a new way, and that is what Paul is talking about here. Strictly speaking, he's talking about the Mosaic law here that was written down. All right, so what does it mean to be in the flesh? Now, Galatians 2:20, and this is, I'm mentioning this to you because when we read the Bible and we read one thing, I want you to know it doesn't always mean the same thing every time you read it. A really classic example of this is when Peter is drowning in the Gospels and he cries out, Lord, save me! And the Lord saves him. Right? Is that when Peter was converted? No, and that's obvious. How is he saving him? Saving him from drowning, right, in the ocean or the sea there of Galilee. That's what he was saving him from. So context is a very important part of understanding the Bible. You can't just look up a word, see the definition, pick the one that you like or the one that's the first one in the dictionary or the one that pastors always talk about all the time and just go with it. You have to see what the options are, look at the context, and you have to work at it. Sometimes we're racing through our Bible study and we read something, we automatically think we know what it's talking about and we just go with that. In this case, in the flesh, I just want to point out, doesn't always mean the same thing. Galatians 2:20, Paul says, I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live. But the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God. So he's saying, as a Christian, I live in the flesh by faith. Well, how does that work? You live in the flesh every single day of your life, and that's normal. It's not bad, according to Galatians 2:20. But here, he is using in the flesh to describe the way your life was before you were saved. And so that's the way we have to understand it here. He's using this phrase to describe our lives before conversion, which was characterized by something other than what it's characterized by today. How does passions describe the way that sin operates in our lives? I pointed out to those who just got in, this word passions is not epithumia. It is not speaking about lustful desires. Which is, again, in our Bible reading, we might just automatically associate. If you don't have a good study Bible or dictionary or looking things up, you say, oh, I know what this is. This is talking about lustful desires to sin. That is not what this is talking about. This is a word that means suffering, affliction, tormented emotions, sickness, sorrow, misfortune, illness, disease. These are words that help us fill out the range of meaning of this word. So, what this is talking about is when you're not a Christian, you know what this is like. It's It's the way that sin flares up. And it's a suffering existence. You wish it would go away. You wish you could live a day without these urges to sin, but it's a suffering we all have. It's like a disease. Now, when I say sin is like a disease, I'm talking about this verse. I do not mean sin is just a disease. It's not wicked, it's not evil, it's not perverted, it's not bad. It's just a disease that you suffer with. I'm not saying that. It's very bad. But in this case, Paul is pointing out it is like a disease, a really bad one. And it's painful. You suffer through it. And the more you know about law from God, the more you suffer. The more you have a hard time. That's why you don't want to go to church. You don't want to meet another Christian. You don't want to read the Bible. You don't want to have anything to do with religion. Because the more you're around it, the more you're painfully aware that you have a lot of problems in your flesh. And so it's easier just to stay away, because the more you know, the more you suffer with that. That's what Paul is talking about. What kind of effects does the law have on a non-believer's sinful desires? Fascinating, and Paul will develop this further in our next lesson, but the law is good. The law is from God. The law shows us how much we need God because we're not good. However, the law, because we're so bad, has this other residual effect. It makes us want to sin. Even as much as we suffer with this struggle of sin in us, it makes us want to do it. Romans 7:7-8 talk about this more in depth. The law is supposed to show you what sin is, and the irony is it actually makes us want to do it. That's how bad we are. It's not the law's fault that we have that response. The law isn't bad because we have that response, but we have that response. And you know the regular common way to illustrate this is, if you put a sign up on the wall that says, wet paint, don't touch, what do you want to do? Is it dry yet? You want to touch it. Do not walk on the grass. What do you want to do? Walk on the grass. If the sign wasn't there, you wouldn't even think about it. You have other things on your mind, but as soon as there's a law, you want to do it. And this is one of the difficulties in churches that we have to watch out for today. In our desire to have good, godly churches, we create a lot of laws that aren't even written down. Now, if you have a Christian school in your church and things like that, then you have a lot of rules written down that are kind of throughout the church because people are in the school. But we have a lot of laws written and unwritten that Christians do, and different cultures have different versions of these laws, the way that Christians behave. And in a church like ours, that can get very complicated sometimes. What is your Christian rules? What are your Christian rules? What is your Christian rule? And you're always trying to unpack that, and it's trying to just get it. That's painful, and it makes me want to do those things just to show you that there's nothing wrong with doing that. But I'm not going to do that because I don't want to offend you. And it's a painful way of living, and we bring that into Christianity. Young people grow up in the church and they say, this is too complicated. This is too hard. You're on pins and needles all the time. It's just much easier to go out here and just do whatever. And then young people often will just do whatever. Well, that's wrong too. And then you actually start doing things that just are not in character with God. Not because there's not a rule, it's just God isn't like that. So we have to be sensitive and aware of this and make sure that we don't bring law-based living into our Christian lives today. Because the more laws you introduce, no matter how well-intended they are, the more you create a desire inside people to actually break those rules. And you multiply guilt where guilt did not need to exist. Guilt needs to concentrate on what really is wrong, not the periphery stuff that are subjective, personal things. In what ways do the sinful desires of a non-believer bring about death? Well, we've talked about death. Eventually, you physically die, right? The more rules you break, sometimes you die because of, under the Mosaic law, capital punishment. You break certain rules. You disobey your mom and dad enough, you could get stoned to death. In that sense, death is the result. But in so many other ways, Christian homes, churches, Christianity in general, that is heavily rule-based, relationships suffer where they should not have to suffer. There's separation, generational separation, spiritual separation, social, because one will disown the other because of this kind of separation from God. People will be distanced more from God. They're not interested in relationship with God because of all this kind of thing.
This is the result of rule-based legalistic living. It produces death. On a lot of different levels. Death. We know what that's like in the world. People who can't help but just sin. This is the story of their life. But we add this into our Christian lives to be godly, and we end up cutting people off. Why it's very important not to rely on laws as a way to grow spiritually. Because laws do not bring life. They actually bring death. We have to be very careful we do not rely on them for spiritual growth. Because they will have the opposite effect. How have we been delivered from the law? According to verse 6.
What does it say? We live by grace. We no longer, we have been released, detached, uncoupled. It's like the train going up the hill with a long trail of cars behind, and it's gone real slow. Gone real slow. And then one person gets the bright idea. Why are we hauling all these cars? There's nothing in them. And they go back and they detach the cars. They go wheeling down the track. And all of a sudden, the locomotive starts flying up the hill. We have been uncoupled from that crippling weight of guilt that the law gives. And this innate desire to keep breaking all the things that we see. We get uncoupled from that. And we actually will make so much more spiritual progress because we actually are uncoupled from that. We're spending our lives trying to get connected back to it, and that doesn't work. It slows you down. This does not mean we are free to do whatever we want, right? And I'm not going to talk about that a lot, because Paul will defend that later on, and he has in Romans 6 already. This is the whole problem that he's dealing with. People are accusing him of saying the law is bad, and no, he's not. But you don't just do whatever you want. You go after God. You focus on a close, vibrant relationship with God. You learn who is Jesus Christ in the Scriptures. You depend on the Holy Spirit who lives within you. And you study the Bible for yourself. And you learn all these things about God. And you don't walk away from the New Testament with a bunch of rules in your head. You walk away saying, God is great. Christ is amazing. The gospel is powerful. The Holy Spirit empowers me, and I get to be like God. Like I can actually live my day-to-day loving God and loving other people. This idea of being uncoupled, being delivered, it's kind of like the person who is placed under house arrest. They're put into their house, but they have an ankle bracelet. And because of that ankle bracelet, they can only go to a certain area. They can't cross over certain lines. There's a lot of rules about things they have to follow. But then there comes the day when they are unhitched from the ankle bracelet. That doesn't mean, oh yes, now I can go commit crimes again. That is not what that means. That's not the significance of that release. What it means is you can go live now, not with this desire to not get in trouble so I can not go back to jail. The issue is, I can now live like a mature, responsible person and do life the way it's supposed to be lived without having all these restrictions that are artificially placed on me to keep me out of trouble, which is what the law does. I don't live my life every day staring at every speed limit sign. I do stare at a lot of parking violation signs. Okay, make sure I'm parking in the right place. But when I'm walking around, I don't stop. Is there a police officer over here? Oh, I'm going to cross the street carefully here. And you know, if you live that way, I pity you. In New York City, you have to live that way a little bit. But the more you live life, that's what you do. You just live life. You get done what you have to get done. You treat people well and fairly, and you make progress in your day. You don't walk around harassed by laws all day. Yesterday, how many things did you do because of laws? Well, you followed a lot of laws yesterday. You obeyed a lot of laws yesterday if you did right, but not because you were thinking about them. That's just how you live. Did anyone steal something from the store yesterday? No, I didn't, because there's a law about that, and I don't want to get in trouble for that. That's not why most of us don't steal now, right? Why? That's not what we do. It's just not who we are anymore. When I was a kid, I was tempted sometimes, but I don't live like that. And as Christians, you set up all these laws. What do? It's like we bring that house arrest version of life back into Christianity, and we don't do a lot of things, and we do a lot of things, but we sure wish we could have done those things, but we don't because half those things aren't even in the Bible. That's a tortured way of living, and God does not look down and say, you are a godly person. This is wonderful. He says, stop. That's not why I saved you. It's not how you're to live. You're turning people away from Christ. What is the newness of the Spirit? The short answer to this is what Paul is going to talk about the rest of Romans chapter 7. But the newness of the Spirit, in summary, is a new way of living that was not possible before Christ died and resurrected and before you were saved. It is a life governed by the Holy Spirit who lives within us, rather than an exhaustive collection of rules and regulations pressed upon us, written down in the Mosaic law, and sometimes we add them in ourselves. This new way of life does not abandon godly morals, but it relies on a new and a close relationship with God that learns to love God and neighbor from the heart in reliance on the Spirit, the way the gospel teaches me to do, because that's how Christ lived. And the Spirit enables me to live that way and gives me wisdom and strength to do it. It's learning who God is through Christ and the Scriptures, depending on the Spirit of God, to live like that. If you say, hey, why did you do that or not do that? Your answer should not be, well, in the book of Leviticus, it says that's law-based living. The correct answer would be something like, because that's not like God. That wouldn't be loving. That wouldn't put the other person first. That's the correct answer. But we don't live like that. So we end up just living for ourselves. It's much easier to do that. And then just make sure we don't break rules in public or the ones we won't get caught for. And then we look spiritual because we follow the surface laws of how you're supposed to dress at that church. And everyone thinks you're great. But you're not walking with God. So much I could say. The oldness of the letter, of course, is living in bondage to the written regulations of the law of Moses. And you can add to that all the other laws that we add today that are neither here nor there. When you study the ministry of Jesus, Jesus said harsher things, sharpest things to people for legalistic living than he, and that was on before the cross. Even when the law was in force, he had hard things to say about legalistic living. He said, some of you guys are creating rules that are nothing more than traditions of men, and then you're teaching them like God said them. And he had harsh words for that. The sinners who had broken the moral code of God, if they came to him in repentance, he didn't rub it in. He would just show grace and forgiveness to them and pick them up and lead them forward. And the Pharisees would look at that and say, how can you do that? That person did this. We should be killing them for that. He said, yeah, and we should be killing you for some things too. Whoever didn't do that, pick up the first stone. Everyone would walk away. You guys are missing the heart of the law, even when the law is in force. And we still have this urge in us today to go chase laws instead of God.
Thank you for tuning in to the preaching ministry of Faith Baptist Church. We are conveniently located in Corona, New York City, and are devoted to loving God and making disciples. For more resources and helpful information about our church, visit studygodsword.com. We'd also like to extend a personal invitation for you and your family to join us on Sundays at 9:30 in the morning for a time of interactive Bible study for young people and adults, followed by an 11 o'clock worship and preaching service. If you have young children, they will really enjoy our exciting Bible-based children's ministries in both the morning Bible study hour and worship service. If you have any questions about the church or would like to learn how to have a personal relationship with God, please give us a call or leave some feedback at studygodsword.com. We would be thrilled to meet you in person and show you firsthand what God is doing at Faith Baptist Church. Until next time, may God richly bless you.